This week on Making Contact.
My mom kicked me out. Simple as that. She just said, I'd rather have someone else deal with it and deal with the headache than me.
Thousands of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer youth are forced out onto the streets each year. LGBTQ youth face harassment, homophobia, and even violence in their own high schools.
One of the football players at the school was telling me that I needed to get out. He was like, MF-er, fag, leave. And I ended up getting into a fight with him.
And there are many LGBTQs outside this country seeking an increasingly difficult path to political asylum in the U.S.
Because I didn't fit the stereotypical image of a lesbian, it was more difficult to convince the officials that I am gay.
On this edition, we'll hear from the LGBTQ community, on the streets, in the schools, and outside the system. I'm Tina Rubio, your host on Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. How many LGBTQ youth are homeless across the U.S.? It's a difficult number to track. According to the Safe Schools Coalition, many of the statistics are based on surveys, reports, and articles that go as far back as 1980. But it seems safe to say that out of the reported 1 million homeless youth in the U.S., 25 to 40% are LGBTQ youth. That's as many as 400,000 12 to 23-year-olds out on the streets or in shelters struggling for survival. In New York, the percentage of LGBTQ youth on the streets could be even higher than the national average. As Making Contact correspondent Leanne Stanky reports, with less than 50 beds set aside for LGBTQ youth in the Big Apple, the odds at survival are stacked against them.
New York City is a mecca for young gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender youth. Many arrive from other states or even other countries, seeking the tolerance and acceptance they can't find at home.
I hitchhiked from New Mexico to Ohio. I got traveler's aid from Ohio, and I came to New York on a bus.
For some who have a job lined up and a place to stay, New York is welcoming and exciting, a place where they can be themselves. But for others, the city is thrust upon them in an instant.
My mom kicked me out. Simple as that. It was pretty much like, you know, a teen coming into themselves and her not being able to deal and bear. So she just said, I'd rather have someone else deal with it and deal with the headache than me.
That's 19-year-old Bridget, a lesbian-identified youth who was asked to leave her home when her mother caught her kissing another young woman. She was just 11 years old.
I really didn't have a chance to come out. She caught me. So, you know, the experience all in itself is just like, freaked out, get out, and then we'll deal with it as I got older.
So Bridget left. Living on the streets, she did whatever she could each day to find enough money for shelter.
Survival of the fittest, I had a what you call hustle, which is just pretty much, you know, do all kinds of things. You know, get little rinky-dinky jobs, manipulate people, sometimes even escort.
Carl Siciliano, director of the Ali Fournay Center, a small but comprehensive emergency housing program for LGBT youth age 16 to 24, says that Bridget's story is not uncommon.
A number of the young people, when they first come to us, you know, not only do they have no money and no food, but they have no wallets and no identification. A real common story that I hear is that the parents find out that the kid is gay, and that night they're told to put their belongings in a garbage bag and hit the streets.
After being homeless for several months, then 12-year-old Bridget was ushered into a group home by city services. At age 17, she was too old for foster care and out on the streets again. Employed, but in need of a place to stay, she checked herself into Covenant House, New York City's largest shelter for homeless youth. Located in Midtown Manhattan near Port Authority, Covenant House is often the first stop for homeless teens who are new to New York. Bridget wasn't new to the city, but she found Cove House chaotic and frightening. The longer Bridget stayed, the more dangerous it became. As soon as the other residents found out she was gay, she was harassed and threatened.
I actually had roommates who swore that I actually wanted to, like, they didn't want to sleep with me because they thought I was going to, like, come on to them. I'm just like, bro, I may be gay, but you're not really all that cute. You know, just because I'm gay doesn't mean I'm going to, like, throw myself at you and be like, oh, you're a woman, I love you, I want you. No, and I've had people sit there and, like, threaten to throw blow dryers in the shower when I was taking a shower. I've had people put urine and bleach in my shampoo. I've had people rip up my clothes. I've had people sit there and, like, wait for me to come home from work. And, like, because I would usually come home, like, around 10, 11 o'clock, wait for me outside and, like, throw cigarettes at me and, you know, just all kinds of stuff. I was actually afraid to, like, leave. I knew if I didn't leave, it can happen inside also. Like, I had numerous fights inside and nothing happened.
Bridget says Covenant House, who declined to be interviewed for this story, did little to protect her or other GLBT youth. Kate Barnhart is the manager of Sylvia's Place, a 10-bed emergency facility in Midtown Manhattan for homeless GLBT youth. Many Sylvia's Place residents arrived there after a brief disturbing stay at Covenant House. While her residents set up the cots they'd be sleeping on that night, Kate explained why Covenant House, a large shelter affiliated with the Catholic Church, has not been a blessing for GLBT youth.
Well, a lot of the young people who come here come in with horror stories from Covenant House of being verbally or physically harassed by both peers and staff. I've had one young man who showed up here black and blue from head to toe because he had been beaten up. The staff had not intervened. We've had a lot of young people who had been the victim of incidents and had been discharged supposedly for their own safety. We had a young woman who came here after being raped by other young people at Covenant House. She had been the victim of an escalating pattern of harassment, people calling her dyke and harassing her. Eventually, some of the boys followed her from Covenant House, pulled her into an abandoned building and raped her. And when she reported this to the police and the Covenant House, she was discharged and wound up here.
Many GLBT youth say they'd rather spend the night on the street than go back to Covenant House. But the streets are dangerous as well. Again, Kate Barnhart.
Being out on the street, they're at risk for, you know, being bashed, homophobic attacks. They often are forced into sex work or survival sex, which is dangerous. They can catch HIV. They can be, you know, kidnapped and abused. They can be pimped or trafficked. They also are, of course, at risk for mental illness, including suicide and also addiction of various kinds. So, I mean, the risks of being on the street are huge for this population, and so it's incredibly important that we get them into shelter.
Allie Fournet founder Carl Siciliano agrees.
We offer a variety of stabilizing and supportive services. We offer food and showers and case management. We also have a mental health program. We have a psychiatrist here every week. We have a medical program. We have a doctor here every week. We're able to do primary medical care, HIV testing, ongoing mental health treatment. We've recently started a job training program where we're looking to place our young people in jobs and help them to, you know, get away from prostitution, which many of them do to survive. And we're starting a new project here as well where we're reaching out to parents and helping to educate them and try to improve the communication between the parents and the kids so that the parents don't put their kids out on the streets for being gay in the first place.
With less than 50 shelter beds in New York City allocated specifically for GLBT homeless youth, many feel the city should be doing more. When asked to justify why federal and local governments should allocate more money to small, service-intensive GLBT-friendly programs like the Allie Fournet Center, Director Carl Siciliano has a simple answer.
It works. A lot of homeless youth programs are kind of like revolving doors where the kids come in and go out and they come in and they stay for a while and then they leave and they go back to the streets. It's really hard to stabilize young people and it's really hard to get them off the streets. It's something that's challenging. And I think that the model that we're offering, where we're combining safe and dignified home-like environments with a wealth of clinical and supportive services, is really effective. And, you know, the majority of the young people who come and stay with us for more than 30 days are moving on. They're moving on into their own apartments. They're getting jobs. They're going to school. It's something that I'm very, very proud of. And I think that what we're doing is very, very effective.
Change is coming slowly, but there is progress. In April of 2005, New York City Council members Lou Fidler and Alan Gerson sponsored a proposal that granted $1.4 million to emergency shelter and transitional beds for GLBT homeless youth in New York City. The money was divided equally among Sylvia's Place, Allie Fournay, and a center called Green Chimneys, which provides homeless youth with the opportunity to live on a farm while they develop a plan to become self-supporting. Bridget is now employed, lives in her own apartment, and volunteers with homeless GLBT youth at Sylvia's Place. She is one of the lucky few. As she tells it, she received the services she needed when she needed them, thanks to a serendipitous meeting.
I actually ran into somebody who went to church upstairs from Sylvia's. They heard me singing on the train, and they asked me to come to church and sing for the church. When Jesus is my portion. And I started coming to the church, and I found out eventually that there was a shelter downstairs.
Given the lack of services in New York City, Bridget's success story is rare. Most homeless GLBT youth are not matched with a center that offers them targeted services, and they don't leave the streets singing. For Making Contact in New York, I'm Leanne Stanky. We'll have more in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcast at radioproject.org. According to the Allie Fournay Center, 97% of the LGBTQ students in U.S. public high schools say they regularly hear homophobic remarks from their peers. Nearly 24% say they've heard those remarks from faculty and staff. And the center reports that LGBTQ students are twice as likely to be injured or threatened with a weapon at school than their heterosexual peers. So what's being done to foster a safe and effective learning environment for LGBTQ youth? The District of Columbia School District is one of many tackling that issue. But is it enough? Making Contact's correspondent, Selena Masuta, reports from the nation's capital.
You're ugly.
You're ugly too. I mean, like, bad.
You burn my eyes.
Well, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me.
That's a clip from a one-minute claymation video by Jack Evans and Kit Hall, featured on a website called YouTube.com. The video is supposed to be humorous and sarcastic, but for many working to combat bullying in schools, taunting is no laughing matter.
It makes us angry and bitter, and it causes, like, harassment causes more misunderstanding.
In fact, school health officials say victims of bullying can suffer severe mental and physical breakdowns, and it's an even bigger problem for students who identify or are perceived as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or queer, also known as LGBTQ.
I was visiting one of my friend's classrooms during my lunch break, and one of the football players at the school was telling me that I needed to get out. He was like, "You need to leave here, you MFer, fag, leave." And he proceeded to stand up, walk towards me, and push me, and I ended up getting into a fight with him.
And LGBTQ youth advocates say many LGBTQ students find little protection in schools across the U.S., but the District of Columbia Public Schools, or DCPS, is trying to change that. How? Bullying based on sexual orientation is addressed under the DCPS school sexual harassment policy. However, many LGBTQ youth service providers say DCPS has failed to implement that policy, which became law in 2000. In fact, it seems many DC students are unaware of their right to confront harassment using their own school system's policy. Darlene Nipper, director of the Office of LGBT Affairs of the DC City Government, says that because of DCPS's independent relationship with the city, it has been a challenge to address the issue of harassment at the school level.
When you have a complete system within a system, you know, you just build up layers of barriers, more people that need to be talked to, you know, more direction that needs to be given, and then you're doing it from almost the outside, even though people are saying, well, what are you talking about? It's the DC public school system. You're working for the executive office of the mayor.
26-year-old Jay Harris an LGBTQ youth advocate, agrees with Nipper. Harris is also the Safe Schools Coordinator for the Metro DC chapter of a national organization called Parents, Families, and Friends of Lesbians and Gays. She has spent a little bit more than half the year eating lunch twice a week with LGBTQ youth at two DC high schools, Roosevelt and H.G. Woodson. An out queer person herself, Harris spends time with the teens facilitating various discussions on topics like coming out, to dating, and sometimes about bullying.
When you speak to people, they don't even really know that the policy exists. And so they don't even know that they're protected, you know, from this type of treatment.
And although it's her job to promote safe and affirmative school environments for LGBTQ youth in the greater metropolitan area, Harris says it isn't easy.
You know, most of the principals are concerned with test scores and improving their test scores and academics. But the thing that they need to realize is that safety and grades are kind of tied and together, because if I'm afraid to go to school because I'm going to get bullied, I'm not going to go, or I'm not going to be focused on my studies. But if I feel like school is safe, then I'll be more, you know, I'll be prone to go and do my studies and get good grades.
Harris is also in the process of creating a Safe Schools Coalition with other youth groups that serve DC's LGBTQ youth. One of those groups, the Sexual Minority Youth Assistance League, or SMILE. SMILE is dedicated solely to supporting D.C. area's LGBTQ youth, which is mostly Black and Latino. When Bruce Weiss, the director of SMILE, tells LGBT adults where he works, many say they wish that a group like SMILE was around when they were kids.
I don't think the general community at large really even understands how difficult it is for youth living in the district, African-American youth, and the challenges that they're facing. And I think also Latino-Latina youth who I think are some years behind in terms of a community, of a movement.
More than 2 years ago, Weiss wanted to help remedy that lack of visibility, so he organized a youth forum with the National Black Justice Coalition, National Youth Advocacy Coalition, and the Human Rights Campaign. Out of that forum came a document called Confronting the Crisis, Issues Facing Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender, and Questioning Youth, Especially Youth of Color.
At the top of the list of things they were concerned about were issues related to violence in the schools, unsafe schools, youth dropping out of school because they were so afraid to go, issues around being thrown out of their houses, lack of jobs and job opportunities because of discrimination based on them being lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender.
Weiss says many youth who endure daily violence at school end up fighting or bringing weapons to school for protection. As a result, they often find themselves suspended or in trouble with the law.
We've had youth that have been thrown out of school because they carried knives to school because they were being told by people, we're going to get you, we're going to kill you, we're going to hurt you. And so they'd bring weapons and then they'd get caught and then they would be expelled. And this is a true thing that has happened. You know, it's really unfortunate that that's the choice that they had, go to school and arm myself or drop out and not go to school.
I interviewed a newcomer to SMILE, Maureen Curtis, who just recently moved from Memphis, Tennessee to D.C. Curtis recounted his principal's reaction at an incident at his Memphis school where Curtis got into a fight with a football player after the football player made homophobic remarks and told him to get out of the class.
And we were both sent to see the principal, and it was right before Thanksgiving break, and he said that he'd deal with it when we got back from break. Well, I never even heard anything else about it because I think he didn't want the football player to get kicked off the football team.
Few surveys have been conducted on how bullying affects lesbian, gay, bisexual, and queer students. Less has been done on transgender students. One group that has consistently researched LGBTQ youth is the Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network, or GLSEN. GLSEN recently put out two surveys in the last year documenting the experiences of students who identify as LGBTQ in U.S. schools. GLSEN surveyed 1,700 LGBTQ-identified youth and found that students continue to face hostile school environments.
Passing a policy, it's important to realize, is the end of the beginning of what you need to do, not the beginning of the end.
That was Kevin Jennings, the founder and executive director of GLSEN. Jennings says that one of the problems in addressing bullying in schools is that there must be better data to illustrate whether LGBTQ students are being negatively affected disproportionately.
And it's important that states and polities such as the District of Columbia include questions about issues of sexual orientation and gender identity, the states that have done that, such as Massachusetts, have indeed found that LGBT students are having a harder time in school than non-LGBT students, and that has led them to take important steps to correct that achievement gap.
Meanwhile, the District of Columbia Public Schools will continue to take steps towards moving the sexual harassment policy off the shelves and into the hands of teachers, principals, school administrators, and students. D.C. Superintendent Clifford B. Cheney sent a memo to all DCPS principals stating they must adhere to the sexual harassment policy. That means principals must identify two go-to people for students and advertise the sexual harassment policy to their student bodies. For Making Contact in Washington, D.C., I am Selena Masuda.
Fear of persecution or torture for who they are. Looking for acceptance and an opportunity to live life on their own terms. Each year it's said that hundreds of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender immigrants seek political asylum in the U.S., but it's not by any means an easy road to travel. Making Contact's correspondent Darby Hickey reports from Washington, D.C. on the significant obstacles LGBTs face while trying to obtain political asylum in the U.S., and on what LGBT advocates are doing to change that.
Mi nombre es Dilcia Molina, vivo en este país en asilo político por opción sexual. Soy lesbiana con dos hijos.
Her name is Dilcia Molina, a lesbian mother of two, a political activist living in political asylum. For Dilcia, telling the story of her journey to the U.S. is difficult. That's because to recount it means reliving the past, a past filled with anger, fear, and torture.
Porque venía con dos hijos que habían sido torturados. Bueno, todavía... Es difícil para mí. Y uf, creí que lo había superado.
Dilcia is from Honduras in Central America, where she encountered an almost deadly combination of homophobia and government repression because of her advocacy for the human rights of lesbians, gays, transgenders, and others. In November of 2001, while she was out of the country, Dilcia says paramilitaries affiliated with the Honduran government broke into her house and tortured her 6 and 8-year-old sons and their caretaker. The paramilitaries demanded to know her whereabouts and threatened to rape and kill her when she returned. A week later, Dilcia and her sons traveled to the U.S. on a tourist visa where they applied for and eventually received political asylum in the United States.
Es doloroso revictimizarnos para poder convencer a un funcionario de migración, al gobierno y a este estado, a este país, de que realmente vivimos crímenes y violación a nuestros derechos humanos.
Although she's glad for the opportunity, Dilcia says that seeking asylum was difficult because she felt re-traumatized by the process of having to prove to a U.S. government official that her torture and persecution were real. Chris Nugent, an attorney for Holland & Knight in Washington, D.C., who works on political asylum cases, agrees. Nugent says LGBT and HIV-positive asylum seekers face a particularly difficult emotional as well as legal challenge.
These experiences and their fears strike at their very core of their identities. You know, when I work with political dissidents who have spoken out against the government, they feel entitled to vindicate their rights, even if they've been tortured. But when it's GLBT or HIV, they somehow feel, maybe I deserve this.
Despite the challenges, asylum remains an important tool for LGBT immigrants. This is a giant leap from the past when quote-unquote homosexuals were barred from entering the U.S. That ban ended in 1990. During the Clinton administration, the option of political asylum opened up for the LGBT community, says Bill Strasburger, public affairs officer for U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services.
In 1994, Attorney General Reno, at the time, made a decision that homosexuality could be grounds for asylum. Then it was just a matter of having to establish that the person had, in fact, experienced persecution or had a well-founded fear of persecution based on the homosexuality.
My father used to be violent, and actually when he found out that I was gay, he decided that he was going to set me on fire.
Fear of persecution is real for Farah Perry, a 20-year-old lesbian from the Congo in Central Africa, who asked to use a pseudonym. After living for 7 years in the U.S. under the abusive hand of her father, the young woman took matters into her own hands. She applied for political asylum and got it, which inspired her mother to do the same. LGBT immigrants like Farrah Perry can apply for political asylum because of their fear of persecution as a member of a social group. The other qualifying categories are race, religion, national origin, and political opinion. An immigrant in the U.S., documented or not, can make an affirmative application for asylum and present his or her case to an asylum officer with the Department of Homeland Security. Throughout this process, LGBT asylum seekers often encounter homophobic attitudes, says Delcia Molina, who now has helped 24 other immigrants to gain asylum.
Because I didn't fit the stereotypical image of a lesbian, it was more difficult to convince the officials that I am gay. And the worst was that I have two sons. That was the worst.
Congress addressed asylum issues with the Real ID Act of 2005. Viewed by many as a precursor to the creation of a national ID card, the act adds yet another layer of bureaucracy and potential legal roadblocks for LGBT refugees. Placing an applicant's asylum status into the hands of immigration judges and officials, individual biases and opinions are given the final word in what are for some life or death decisions. Those immigrants with HIV or prior prostitution arrests are usually barred from legal avenues of immigrating to the U.S., disproportionately impacting LGBT asylum seekers. Delcia Molina, an organizer with Mujeres de la Madre Tierra in Northern Virginia, says LGBT immigrants' rights have not been addressed by the larger immigrants' rights movements.
They're terribly homophobic, really. I think they could do something for our issues, but it's not a priority in their agenda. Actually, I don't think it's even on their agenda, even at the bottom of the list.
On the flip side, mainstream LGBT groups have not made connections to the immigrants' rights movement, says Ruby Corrado. She's a leader in Washington, D.C.'s transgender community who emigrated from El Salvador in the late 1980s and was granted asylum.
You know, we have a great LGBT movement, but it's a separate movement. There are other movements going on in this country. Why aren't we finding common ground with those movements to strengthen our own movement?
For Jaime Contreras, chair of the National Capital Immigration Coalition, any changes to immigration laws should be comprehensive and address the lives of all immigrants.
A fair immigration reform will have to deal with people who are coming here fleeing persecution or to come here to express their freedom of speech or their religion or, you know, sexual rights. An immigration reform would have to deal with the fact that there are real human beings with real needs.
Ruby Corrado says that despite the homophobia of many mainstream immigrant rights groups, many LGBT immigrants are the movement's unacknowledged leaders.
After they have endured a lot of pain, a lot of discrimination, they have endured a lot of violence, and I think one of the contributions that we do is we bring a perspective on real human issues. And there's a lot of LGBT people who tend to go and work on social justice issues.
And whether for Farrah Perry from Congo or Dilcia from Honduras, fighting for social justice can't just be about escaping persecution, but about ending it everywhere. For Making Contact, I'm Darby Hickey in Washington, D.C.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to freelance producers Leanne Stanky, Selena Masuta, Darby Hickey, and to Dan Turner, Ronald Rucker, and Yusu Nagata. For a CD copy of program number 2406, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736 or go to radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Dorian Taylor communications manager, Stefana Petrova and Alina Potts production interns. And I'm your host and senior producer, Tina Rubio. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.